From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane, sitting in today for Terry Gross. Dorothy Beam's son Joe died of AIDS 3 years ago as he was working on his second anthology of gay black writing. After his death, Dorothy decided that she could finish that collection. On this edition of Fresh Air, Dorothy Beam talks with us about continuing her son's work. Also, we'll talk with Nigerian-born writer Ben Okri, who won the 1991 Booker Prize for his novel, The Famished Road. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a reissue of some Thelonious Monk recordings. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. 38 Haitians were intercepted today by the U.S. Coast Guard and sent directly back to Haiti under an executive order by President Bush. So far, the Bush administration says the flow of refugees from Haiti has slowed in recent days to a trickle. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
The State Department denied that a White House executive order could result in the return of some Haitians who are entitled to political asylum. Over the weekend, President Bush ordered the Coast Guard to immediately return any Haitian boat people, instead of taking them for screening to the overcrowded tent city at the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher said Haitians picked up under the new policy would be able to apply for political asylum aboard U.S. Coast Guard cutters en route to being repatriated. Boucher said 17 Haitians did so today before being sent back home. Meanwhile, Haitian refugee advocates are expected to challenge President Bush's executive order tomorrow in U.S. District Court in New York. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
The Bush administration said today that it would allow the sale of many genetically engineered plant foods, including fruits, vegetables, and grains, without additional government testing. The policy applies to foods that have been genetically altered in an effort to improve quality, such as their flavor, appearance, or resistance to spoilage. The policy was outlined today by Vice President Dan Quayle. Critics said the policy doesn't provide adequate safety precautions for the new products. The bioengineered food products include a genetically altered tomato that resists spoilage and can be ripened before it's picked and shipped. Developers say the product could be on the supermarket shelves by late next year. Expectant mothers and their babies were forced to seek shelter underground after a large maternity hospital in Sarajevo was hit by Serbian artillery and rocket fire. Pierre Vickery reports at least 60 people are reported to have been killed in fighting in Sarajevo and other Bosnian cities.
Eyewitnesses in Sarajevo said the maternity hospital was hit by Serbian artillery and rocket shells shortly before dusk, setting fire to the building's upper stories. Flames and dense black smoke billowed into the sky against a backdrop of a distinctive red cross on the hospital's roof. The hospital director, Srečko Simic, went on local radio to appeal for a halt to the bombardment, saying there were 173 babies receiving medical treatment and over 70 women waiting to give birth. The attack followed talks between the Bosnian president and the Russian foreign minister, Andrei Kozyrev, aimed at securing a new ceasefire and the reopening of Sarajevo's airport. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 22 points to close at 3,364. Declines led advances by a margin of nearly 2-1. This is NPR. The Supreme Court ruled today that it's up to Congress, not the courts, to decide whether state and local governments may impose sales and use taxes on the multi-billion dollar mail order business throughout the country. NPR's Nina Totenberg has more.
25 years ago, the Supreme Court ruled that a state could not impose tax obligations on companies that had no physical presence in the state. That left out-of-state companies free to conduct tax-free mail order transactions. But since the court's 1967 ruling, the nature of the mail order business has been revolutionized and computerized, and more than half the states told the U.S. Supreme Court this term that its 25-year-old ruling was now obsolete. Today, the High Court agreed in part, but the justices ruled nonetheless that under the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, only Congress and not the courts could allow state and local governments to impose sales and use taxes on mail-order companies. Congressional proponents of legislation to impose state and local taxes on direct marketers, however, are not optimistic about legislative victories in the near future. First of all, direct marketers are, by their nature, masters of direct mail campaigns, and in 1989, they generated 750,000 postcards to Congress to kill such proposed legislation. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
The White House skirmished today with a House Democratic leader over a proposed constitutional amendment that would require the federal budget to be balanced. House Budget Chairman Leon Panetta released a study showing that such an amendment would require $560 billion in program cuts and tax increases over the next 5 years. President Bush supports a balanced budget amendment, and today White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater charged that the Democrats were crying wolf. He said the administration believes there's plenty of room to cut spending in the budget without endangering essential programs. Congress is expected to approve a balanced budget amendment as early as next month. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane. Joe Beam was a black gay writer. In 1986, he published the first anthology of black gay writing called In the Life. He was at work on a second edition when he died of AIDS in 1988. He was 33 at the time. The book didn't end with Joe's death because after he died, his mother, Dorothy Beam, did an exceptional thing. She picked up where Joe left off. With the help of poet Essex Hempel, she finished the book. It's called Brother to Brother. Dorothy Beam and her husband, Sonny, live in Philadelphia, just west of the downtown Center City section where Joe lived and worked. We invited Dorothy Beam on to talk with us about the book and how her life has changed since its publication. She told me how she first learned her son was gay.
Well, it came out of a clear blue sky, to be honest, because we didn't know. I was very naive about gays and lesbians. In fact, I didn't know anything about it. And my son had come in from college, and he said, "Dad, Mom, I want to talk to you." And he said, "Well, I'm gay."
Just as simple as that.
Oh, yeah. He just came right out with it. And well, how can you polish it up? Well, I was taken aback, but I said to him, "Joe, if you had been a lawyer, I would love you. If you'd have been a doctor, I'd love you." I said, "I'll love you even more that you're gay, because you're going to need a lot of support, an awful lot of support."
And were you concerned about the kind of life that he would have or the kind of life that he was having?
I was terrified because I had heard enough to know there was a great deal of gay bashing going on. And I know it's a cruel world out there. And I told him, you know, he's an African male, which is two strikes. Being gay is a triple whammy. That's what I referred to it as, a triple whammy. Not at that time. Later on, I referred to it as a triple whammy. The only thing, after he talked to my husband and I, and he had left the room to go out, my husband didn't feel quite the same way I felt about it. In fact, he still can't accept it. That's why he's not here with me. He doesn't go anywhere with me. And we talked about it. He said that he can't handle it. And he gives me this story. My father wasn't gay, and my grandfather wasn't gay, and I don't know if anybody in my family was gay. I said, well, I don't either. But we have this gay child here. We've got to support him.
Were you literally able to accept it right off the bat? Or was
right
it
off the bat. No. Right. As soon as my son told me there were no ifs, ands, or but about it, I put my arms around him. I told him it was all right. We would work this thing out together, and whatever he wanted to do, it was all right with me. See, I can't stand around and say to him, well, your mother, your father, and I got married, and that's the way it's supposed to be, because when I brought him in the world, I didn't know what he was going to be. I took my chances like everybody else. Just so happens I had a gay son. Yes.
Did you hide the fact at all from your friends and family? Was this an issue that you wanted to keep within your family?
Oh, no. I told everybody that I could think of. I took him everywhere that I ever went. Oh, no. And this is what most people could not understand. My acceptance. They just marveled at it, how I accepted. I said, "What? This is my child. You know, if he was born with one arm, I would accept him. If he was born blind, I would lead him around." This is my son.
You talked about the difficulty of being a gay black man in this country.
Yes.
What were your then greatest fears for him?
Somebody would hurt him. It bothered me all the time. And I used to say to him, Joe, when he finally moved from the apartment building in Overbrook, I said, Joe, be careful how you go out at night. Don't go out alone. Two or three of you go together. Because there was always somebody out to get him. Not just him, any gay or lesbian person. I said, it's better to go to the gay bar. Some of the gay bars, I went with him. I went with him to the gay restaurants. I went with him to the gay bars because I was not ashamed.
And did he like having you there?
Oh, my goodness, yes, yes, yes. I went with him. In fact, a lot of places that I go, and even now, I don't, because I've only been to one since that time to give a girl some information, but they remember me. They said, oh, yes, Mrs. Mew, I remember when you used to come with Joe. I said, yeah. Well, see, because I wasn't ashamed. So I went with him. When his book came out for his first reading at Giovanni's room, his dad went there. And that's when I found out how his father really felt. Because when we came back that evening, he talked to me about it. He said, I'm not going through this again. He really.
Is there anything you could say you think to change your husband's mind?
Oh, no, I can't tell you to change his mind. In fact, I wouldn't know what to say to change his mind. In fact, he says to me even now, he said, I don't know how you can go all these places, how you can be a part of all this. He said, your son has passed. Let it drop. I said, I can't let it drop because my son really died for this book. He worked so hard. He put so much into it. This is a legacy to my son. So I'm working every day. Every day I do something.
When did you find out your son had AIDS?
Oh, now that was a real surprise. I noticed that when Joe came around to the house, to me, he was getting thin. He said, oh, Mom, you always worry. I'm not getting thin. I said, are you eating enough? And one of the things that we did every time we met in town accidentally or by arrangement, I took him out to eat because he was so thin. And then another thing, he was always so tired. And I said, Sonny, I don't know why Joe is always so tired. He felt tired and he required a lot of sleep. And I knew I figured he was using a lot of energy in the book and he was working at Salad Dally. I figured he's working, he's writing a book, and this is why he was so tired. I did not know he had AIDS.
So when did you actually find out he had
I didn't
AIDS?
Find out until after Joe died and the coroners called me and told me that, because we went down to the coroner's office, and my sister and I, and he explained to me what the problem was and why we couldn't see the body and the whole bit. They went through the whole bit with it.
Why do you think your son kept that information
from you? Because my son knew that if I knew that he had AIDS, I would have immediately wanted him to come home. He would have had to give up the apartment. He would have to come home, and I would have to take care of him. And he did not want to do that. He was very independent. And then knowing that I'm a worrywart, if he had told me and remained in Center City, I would have gone crazy. I would have been there practically every day.
Is it possible to describe what it was like to lose your only child?
Oh, it was devastating. When they called me and told me about my son, the landlord where he lived, they called me and told me, he said, Miss Beam, I want you to sit down. He said, Joe, we don't think Joe is not well. And I had the police over there because we had to go into the apartment. He said, I'll call you back. He must have called me back in 2 minutes. He said, well, the police were there and they found Joe dead. I said, okay. Thank you. I said, I'll get back in touch. So he gave me the number, and right away I called my sister. My sister's the one that starts screaming and hollering. I didn't start to scream. I said to her, Margaret, please, I need your help. Don't go to pieces. So I got myself together, and when my sister came, she has a car, and we immediately started to get things rolling. I was fine all the time I was getting out the cards, all the time that I had the memorial services. Everything went beautiful. I didn't collapse until after everything was over, and I went to pieces. I had to have medical care. Mm-hmm. I had to go to my psychiatrist, the whole bit, because I had held it all within me, and my face broke all out. I had to go to a dermatologist. In fact, when I went, I had to wear a cloth or scarf over my head because my face was so bad, I couldn't show my face in public. I had to stay home because I couldn't go out, and my nerves were shot to pieces. I couldn't sleep. It seems to me that I was awake all the time. And when I would try to go to sleep, I couldn't. I couldn't go to sleep. And my husband said, well, you will just have to try to get yourself together. Mm-hmm. I said, no. So for a whole year, I was in there, and I was suffering on the inside. But when somebody would call up, I'd try to, how are you doing? Oh, I'm doing well. But I was so sick, and my hands were all broke out. It was nerves, and the emotion was coming out in my skin. And the only thing I could do was eat, which was the worst thing. But it was like a nervous, I was just constantly eating all the time.
Tell me what it was like for you to begin to go through your son's manuscripts, his letters, his photographs, the things that he kept, which then became part of this second anthology of Black Gay
Writing. That was really a traumatic experience. And my husband was there with me. And, well, it took us it took a couple weeks because I had to go through everything and read through. And the more I read, the worse I kept feeling. And then the depression sets in all over again. And I'd have to read some days, and then I'd have to put the folders away, and then I'd have to go back again.
What made you decide that you wanted to complete what your son had started, which was a second anthology of Black gay writing? What made you think that you could do this?
Well, at first, I didn't think I could do it. That's why I enlisted the help of Essex Hemphill. I'm not a writer. So I said, I have to get someone who I have a feeling that can do the job. And the way I got a hold of Essex was by going through the papers. Because as I went through the papers, he and my son had corresponded a lot. I mean, a lot. And Joe had some of Essex poetry in there. And the rhythm and the letters, the intent of the letters told me that they had a very good relationship going. Then on top of that, when Joe used to go to Washington, he used to stay with Essex. He said, Mother, I stayed with Essex Hemphill. Well, I didn't know Essex Hemphill from anybody, but I remember him saying I stayed at Essex apartment while I was in Washington.
And Essex Hemphill is the editor of this second anthology.
Yes.
You and he then worked together.
We worked together. He lived at my house for 2 years, almost 3 years, and we finished it.
Would you call him your second son?
Well, that's what my husband used to say to me all the time. He said, you really treat Essex like he's your son, and he's got a mother. I don't think his mother's going to like this. Yeah, he used to tell me all the time that he didn't think Essex's mother would like this, that you're trying to take her son away from her. I said, well, no, I'm not really trying to take her son away from her. I said, but Essex has been a help. If it hadn't been for Essex, I wouldn't have known who to get. I didn't know who. If I hadn't gone through the papers, I wouldn't have known, because I didn't know all my son's friends. I was lucky to get Essex.
I want to take a short break, and let me just reintroduce you. And I'm speaking today with Dorothy Beam, and she's a retired Philadelphia guidance counselor. And we're talking about her son, Joe Beam, who died 3 years ago. He was a writer, and before he died, was in the process of editing his second anthology of Black gay writing. Dorothy Beam continued his work along with Essex Hemphill, and now Brother to Brother is out and it's published. And Joe Beam's first anthology of Black gay writing is called In the Life. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Dorothy Beam, and we're talking about her son, Joe Beam, who was a writer, and about the work that she has continued, and this is his work that she has continued. She was involved in the editing of a second anthology of Black gay writing. I must ask you, looking through this anthology, which I did, what it was like for you to read some of these essays, some of these very personal stories, some of them very sexually graphic, and as a mother, looking into, I guess, a life that your son must have left, had led, what was that like for you?
Well, I'll tell you, it was an educational experience, because some of the things that I read about in those books, I didn't even know it happened in the world. I mean, it was like an eye-opener. And then after I read it, I was glad I wrote it, because I feel if we don't know what's going on the other side of the mountain, then we can't help those people. So in reading the books, I have learned a lot that in my wildest dreams I would have never known, because I would, if I had talked to someone, they would not have talked that explicit to me. First thing, I'm an older person, and then being a female, they would have held back. But in writing the book, they came out with their knowledge and their sorrows and their joys, and they were very pacific about it. So through that, I learned a lot.
So you were not shocked?
Oh, no. I wasn't shocked. I was shocked that I didn't know more about what was going on in the gay community. I felt, as I told a couple people, it was a learning experience for me. I didn't even know all these things went on. Oh, my God. I said, I can't believe this. But the things that they wrote about were true and factual, and it was an education. I would have never gotten it other than through Brother the Brother, because I wouldn't pick up those books and read them ordinarily.
Well, I must tell you that I'm absolutely amazed by your open-mindedness, because I think many parents, it doesn't matter whether their children were straight or gay, wouldn't necessarily want to know the kind of sexual activities that they were involved in, or some of the deep, darker side of their personal life.
Well, I didn't want to know it. I wouldn't have gone out. I wouldn't have gone out and purchased Brother the Brother if my son hadn't been gay. But because my son was gay, I had to know what's going on in the gay world. And that was the only way I could find out, is by reading the book. Otherwise, I would have never known all the things that happen in the gay community. But I'm better off for knowing. I'm better off for knowing the troubles, the trials, and the tribulations. And I'm better off for knowing what their sexual desires are, because now that it's necessary for everyone to practice safe sex. How can you practice safe sex if you don't know what they're doing? This way, if you say to someone, practice safe sex, you know what you're talking about. So it was a revelation and an education for me. And Brother the Brother, when I tell people about it, I said, listen, there are a lot of uncomfortable things in there. But it's only through this discomfort that you're going to learn the same way I learned.
Here you are. You're in your 60s. You've retired from...
Yes, I'm 68 today. It's my birthday.
Well, happy birthday.
Thank you.
That's great.
Yes.
Did you think that this is what your retirement was going to be like?
No. I said to my husband, when I retire, we're going to go to Las Vegas. We're going to go to the Bahamas. And we're just going to travel around, because I've never been out of the country. He says, a good idea. But it was not in the cards. I can't travel around unless I travel around for the books. But you see, out of this experience, I'm getting a lot. I'm meeting a lot of people. There are people that I have met that, under ordinary circumstances, I would have never met them, because I wouldn't have been in that particular company. So I have met a lot of fine people.
Do you feel then you're a part of the gay and lesbian community?
Oh, very much so. Very much so. In fact, I get calls every day from somebody that needs some kind of advice, somebody that needs help, just someone to talk to, and they feel that they can talk to me because I understand. Perhaps they can't even, many of them can't talk to their own parents, but they know, well, if I call Miss Beam, I can talk to her and she will understand, because I've been through this. I had a gay son, so I know what they're going through. And then the book helped me to understand the many things, the fears that they have.
Have you been surprised to discover who your son was? And I'm thinking about the kind of contact and the kind of community that he was involved in, but also the effect that he had on the world. Here in Philadelphia, there was a Joe Beam Day.
Yeah.
There are libraries that are interested in his work. Does that surprise you?
It took me by surprise. In fact, the whole business took me by surprise, because I knew my son knew a lot of people, but I did not know he knew thousands. He had a small file box. It must have been 3,000 addresses in there. And when the ladies came down, the gay people came to help me with all the writing. They could not believe. The box was about, 10 or 12 inches. It was like a little file box. And it had nothing but 3x5 cards in there from everywhere in the United States and out of the country. I was overwhelmed. I could not believe that my son knew all these people. And then I could not believe that they knew him. And as I was in Reading Terminal, and I give out the papers about my son. And I said to this young man, my, you're a very nice person, and it's a beautiful coat you're wearing. And I said, if my son had lived, this is the kind of coat that he would have worn. He said, really? And I said, I took a paper out, and I said, my son was Joe Beam. He says, I knew Joe Beam. There's a perfect stranger, but everywhere I go, I talk about my son. The young man said, I knew Joe Beam.
It's obvious that your life has changed
a
lot.
Yes, ma'am.
Since your son died.
Yes.
Do you feel like you really have then embarked on a completely new chapter in your life? Or do you feel that you're sort of mixing things from your past and your old life and working them into your new life now?
No, I think that, you see, out of everything bad, something good happens. Now, if my son had not passed, I wouldn't even be involved with this. But here I was retiring from school. And see, everything worked out because I had retired from school. And then my son passed, which was a traumatic shock. But God gave me something else to do. So I feel that this is a challenge. This is the way God has prepared for me to go. And I just thank the Lord that my health is getting better. My nerves are calming down. And I can go places and do things. This was what God had prepared for me that I didn't even know about. I did not know I had to rise to the challenge of putting the book out, talking to parents, and helping parents to overcome their, because many of our young people are dying, and parents are trying to cope with that every day. I didn't know I would be a solace, a comfort to someone else. I had no idea, because I was looking for comfort myself. But now I have to help others.
Are you a different person because of all this?
Oh, my goodness, yes. Yes, I am. I think I'm a much better person.
Do you?
Yes, because I would have never thought of running around like this before. To comfort anybody, I would have sent a card. I would have sent maybe flowers. Whatever I could have done, I would have. But I would not have gone to visit, and I wouldn't have called people on the phone and extended myself. And now I extend myself to everyone. Listen, I'd be away somewhere on a cruise. You know, I would be doing something different. Really, I would. You know, I really would not be around, and I would have. Moved and got myself a condo. I would be living what you call the good life. But the good life is not always the best life. The good life is sometimes a boring life. This is better. I'm helping others.
Do you think that your son had any idea that you actually might be going through his material, his writings? He knew he was dying.
Oh, yes.
You
yes,
didn't
I had
know
that
he
feeling.
Was dying.
Yeah, yeah. I had
but
that,
did,
yeah.
did you think, since he saved everything, that he knew you were going to come and look through his stuff?
Yes, I would imagine. See, I was a teacher, and my son knew that I saved everything, too. I save every bits of paper. Teachers do that. So he would think to himself, if I save everything, I know my mother will go through. She's that kind of a mother, because she wants to know everything that's happening. Yes, he would say, yes, my mother would go through all this. And I told his dad, I said, if Joe is in heaven, and I feel that he is, he's smiling, he's looking down, smiling down, because he says to himself, I knew that my mother would carry on if anything happened to me, because he had that kind of a mother. I would carry on.
Well, I thank you so much, Dorothy Beam, for joining us today. Thank you. Dorothy Beam served as project manager for her late son's book, Brother to Brother, New Writings by Black Gay Men. Essex Hempel was the editor. The book is published by Allison Publications in Boston. I'm Marty Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is out today, and so, by the way, is one of her wisdom teeth. She returns from the dentist tomorrow. Nigerian-born writer Ben Okri has lived a life split between England and Africa, the real world and the spirit world. Coming up, we'll talk to Ben Okri about those worlds and about his new book, The Famished Road, which won the 1991 Booker Prize for Literature. Also, Dinah, Those Foolish Things and Everything Happens to Me. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new reissue of solo Thelonious Monk recordings. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Israeli warplanes have again attacked suspected guerrilla targets in southern Lebanon. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
It was the third Israeli air raid in 2 days and shows that Israel has taken the offensive against Hezbollah. Both the State Department and the United Nations Secretary General expressed concern about the continuing violence in South Lebanon, and some fear the possibility of a confrontation between Israel and Syria. Reports from Beirut said that Syrian and Lebanese anti-aircraft guns fired at Israeli warplanes but missed. The Israeli Army spokesman denied the report, and Syrian officials did not comment. But if true, it marks the first time since the conflict began a week ago that Syria has become involved. Israeli Defense Minister Moshe Aaron said Israel is not interested in a war with Syria, and he sees little risk of a confrontation. But Syria has 40,000 troops deployed in Lebanon and could be drawn into the fighting. Israel today also said it would continue to attack Hezbollah targets. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
U.S. Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney says that he is still concerned about plans by France and Germany to set up their own army. Both the U.S. and Britain have raised objections to the planned 35,000-member force for fear that it will weaken NATO. There is also concern among U.S. officials that this force could pressure Congress to make more cuts in U.S. troops based in Europe. The Franco-German unit is designed as part of Western Europe's efforts to build up its own defense independent of the United States. Vice President Dan Quayle has told a group of business executives that U.S. biotechnology companies that the government will avoid saddling them with any unnecessary regulations. NPR's Dan Charles reports.
Today's announcement was part of a White House campaign to cut back on government regulations that cost U.S. businesses money. The biotechnology industry uses modern techniques to alter the genetic makeup of foods like tomatoes or corn, making them more resistant to disease, better tasting, and slower to spoil. Under the new rules, the products won't necessarily require government approval. The FDA will have to test and approve only foods that contain new chemicals that are unknown in other foods, or higher levels of natural chemicals that can be dangerous. Environmental groups criticize the new rules, saying it shows that the Bush administration is more interested in promoting biotech industry than in safeguarding America's food supply. They say that new genes inserted through genetic engineering should be handled just like food additives, which require approval from the FDA. This is Dan Charles reporting.
Voters have gone to the polls today in presidential primaries in Kentucky and Arkansas. In Kentucky, Bill Clinton and President Bush are now the projected winners of their various primaries. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 22 points to close at 3,364.21 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Under a new policy announced over the last weekend by President Bush, the U.S. has started returning Haitian boat people straight home without U.S. immigration hearings. According to a White House spokesman, less than 40 people have been sent back home under this new policy. Up to now, Haitian boat people have been taken to a U.S. naval base at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, where they were interviewed by U.S. immigration officers. The new policy has been criticized by human rights groups, who say that it will encourage other nations to send refugees back to countries they flee without screening. In Moscow, the former Soviet Communist Party had a court hearing today on its complaint that President Boris Yeltsin's plan to outlaw the party is not legal. Tim Hewell of the BBC reports.
The Russian government played up the significance of the case because it believed it had turned the tables on the group of communist deputies who instigated it. The communists were challenging President Yeltsin's ban on their party and his confiscation of its assets. But supporters of the president filed a counter-petition questioning whether the party had had any right to exist in the first place. When the court agreed to combine both issues into a single case, the communist representatives were enraged. The party's former deputy general secretary, Vladimir Ivashka, and other leaders present said they had no mandate to defend the organization. They could speak on its behalf only if they were empowered by the Central Committee, but the Central Committee could not meet while the ban on the party remained in force. The hearing has now been adjourned until July the 7th to give the communists a chance to prepare their case.
Tim Hewell in Moscow. Russian President Boris Yeltsin says that while he does not plan to run for a second term in office, he will not step down during his current term. He says no matter how difficult the job becomes, he will not resign. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Ben Okri is a Nigerian writer. His novel, The Famished Road, won the 1991 Booker Prize, Britain's most prestigious fiction award, beating out novels by such well-known writers as Martin Amis. Okri grew up in England and Nigeria and now lives in London. Machiku Kakutani writes in a New York Times review, "A fantastical world in which fairy tale creatures mingle with ordinary human beings, in which the mundane continually fades into the surreal, Mr. Okri's Africa seems like a continent dreamed up in tandem by Hieronymus Bosch and Jorge Luis Borges." The narrator of The Famished Road is a young boy named Azaro, who lives in a poor village in Africa.
One of the reasons I didn't want to be born became clear to me after I had come into the world. I was still very young when, in a daze, I saw Dad swallowed up by a hole in the road. Another time, I saw Mom dangling from the branches of a blue tree. I was 7 years old when I dreamt that my hands were covered with the yellow blood of a stranger. I had no idea whether these images belonged to this life or to a previous one, or to one that was yet to come, or even if they were merely the host of images that invades the minds of all children. When I was very young, I had a clear memory of my life stretching to other lives. There were no distinctions. Sometimes I seemed to be living several lives at once. One lifetime flowed into the others, and all of them flowed into my childhood. As a child, I felt I weighed my mother down. In turn, I felt weighed down by the inscrutability of life. Being born was a shock from which I never recovered. Often, by night or day, voices spoke to me. I came to realize that they were the voices of my spirit companions. "What are you doing here?" one of them would ask. "Living," I would reply. "Living for what?" "I don't know." "Why don't you know? Haven't you seen what lies ahead of you?" "No." Then they showed me images which I couldn't understand. They showed me a prison, a woman covered with golden boils, a long road, pitiless sunlight, a flood, an earthquake, death. "Come back to us," they said. "We miss you by the river. You have deserted us. If you don't come back, we will make your life unbearable." I would start shouting, daring them to do their worst. On one of these occasions, Mom came into the room and stood watching me. When I noticed her, I became silent. Her eyes were bright. She came over, hit me on the head, and said, "Who are you talking to?" "No one," I replied.
What's so striking about your story is how smoothly it moves between the spirit world and the world of the earth. There's no demarcation about what is real and what is not real. Are these the kinds of stories that you heard as a child?
No, the stories one writes are not necessarily the ones that one heard as a child, but they are, let's say, the sort of universes that you inhabited as a child. I think even more than that, I would say that the very fact of having been told stories as a child prepares one to write any kind of story that one is fortunate to get to write as ideas. It's just that I come from a tradition of storytelling, a tradition in which you're told stories as part of the way of making the universe understandable and as a way of cementing relationships between human beings and other human beings, between human beings and animals and trees and sky and darkness and terror.
You were born in Nigeria and you've lived your first 6 or 7 years in England, where your father was studying to be a lawyer. Did you want to go back to Nigeria when his schooling was done?
Oh, when you're a child, you want to stay where you are. I didn't want to go back at all. I was tricked into going back.
How were you tricked?
Mom said, just come see me off, you know, on the ship. Just come and say goodbye.
So you really didn't want to leave England?
No, then. I didn't want to leave at all. I was told all sorts of horrifying stories about Nigeria by my mates, as we say.
How did your mother trick you?
She said, just come see me off. And then I saw her off, and then she said, come see me off, you know, aren't you going to say goodbye to me on the ship itself? And I said goodbye on the ship itself and ended up saying goodbye to England for almost 12 years.
Were you mad at her for doing that?
Well, I was pretty furious, I must admit. I left behind my best, I left behind my great collection of comics. I had the best collection in the whole of South London. It took me a long time to forgive her that.
I can imagine.
But, you know, a child makes a journey across the great ocean. You know, I remember it was a 2-3 week journey. And your fury slowly turns into wonder at this extraordinary thing that you're floating on. And the sea passage itself becomes another sort of ritual. And the next thing I knew, I found myself in a place of wonders and extraordinary events. Because not long afterwards, the Civil War broke out.
What do you remember of the Civil War? And this was the Biafra War.
Oh, things that I'd rather not talk about now and things that I've been trying to live with and trying to write about for the last 19 years. It's one of those things that one struck dumb just trying to remember.
How soon after you got back did the Civil War start?
I think about 6 months, yeah. But there were rumblings and rumors that seemed to be everywhere. And then it just exploded in the middle of my childhood.
If you're just joining us, my guest on Fresh Air today is Ben Okri, and he's a writer, novelist, lives in England, and his latest book, The Famished Road, was the winner of the 1991 Booker Prize for fiction. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with novelist Ben Okri. What were some of the writers that you read as a young boy? Who would you say were the writers that really captivated you?
I love the Greeks.
Why?
Oh, they told fantastic stories. They're unbeatable. They just understood the miraculous art of enchantment. They put you on a horse and put wings on the horse, and they sent you off into the sky of an extraordinary childhood. And they had good names for their horses, Pegasus. They had, you know, the stories of the Medusa. I mean, they just were the great master imaginers of world consciousness. They just knew how to impact into stories, intelligence, wisdom, morality, thoughts about the state, ideas about different dimensions of the human psyche. We're just masters of. And they're perfect for children. They're just wonderful. I mean, I was totally enchanted by Greek legends.
How old were you when you started to read them?
Oh, I started to read them I seem to have been born with them for some reason. I love the Greek legends, not the Romans so much. Those I discovered later. I love books like The Arabian Nights. I loved Mark Twain's Huck Finn, and they're great children's stories. All those stories that you discover twice, if you know what I mean, once as a child and again as an adult, and you are horrified to find that they're in fact two very different kinds of dreams. As I got older, Dad brought back with him from England, I suppose that's one of the great things he did for me, amongst many, a great library of books. He had every single sort of kind of novel, encyclopedias, and so on, which he didn't let me read, and by forbidding me from reading them, he whetted my youthful curiosity and made me read them myself.
Did you have to sneak in to read them?
Oh, yes, I had to sneak in. Usually, he would tell me something like, Ben, I want you to dust down my books and you absolutely must not read them. So I started by dusting them down and ended up by reading as many of them as I could while dusting them, of course.
He knew you were going to read them, right?
I think it was his own rather cunning way of getting me to read them without being forced to do so.
You moved to England 14 years ago. Were you looking to leave Nigeria? I mean, did you want to leave Nigeria?
One never wants to leave home, but the fact that I'd been in England as a kid and that I'd encountered, amongst many other things, the secret enchanting kingdoms in the works of Shakespeare, I suppose made England a sort of a second home. One wanted to go back, and Nigeria was very difficult at the time. It was very difficult to live and grow up in. That connects, of course, the second novel that I wrote called The Landscapes Within, which is a much more painful novel about an artist in a land that is going through difficulties in the aftermath of civil war. It was difficult, and it's difficult if you just also happen to be a part-time dreamer.
It's easier to be a part-time dreamer in England?
It is easier to be it is easier to dream in England. It's easier to write in England, for sure. Nigeria is a much more, as a place to live, it's a place of much more intense realities, for sure. It's got intensities of magic and difficulties and wonder and beauty. It's got many, many kinds of intensities. Well, England is much more serene and much more even. But England's a great place to write. I always say this, and I believe it very firmly. It's a beautiful place to write, because the writer needs partly to be in a magic space where you can conjure and where other people wouldn't come and impose themselves, and where you can go out into the world and carry that magic space with you without, as it were, having the world continually impose on it.
You're talking about privacy, the privacy to write?
Well, not just the privacy, but also certain kinds of notions of social interaction. You can sit on a park bench and still be within the book you're trying to write, and it's only very rarely that people will come up and bother you, and if they do, they usually leave you alone if they get the signals. On the other hand, that may be very difficult if you're not in that state, and you could feel yourself very lonely and very cut off. But for a writer, for an artist, I think it's a very, very unusual place to write. It's lovely.
Ben Okri, thank you for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Oh, thank you very much for asking me.
Ben Okri is a Nigerian writer, and his book, The Famished Road, won the 1991 Booker Prize. This is Fresh Air.
All Things Considered is coming up. Robert Siegel has joined us to tell us about the show today. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Marty. Today we'll have a story about the Food and Drug Administration expected to give approval to genetically altered foods. What a House staff group says it would take to eliminate the federal budget deficit. We'll also hear about how the media have covered the presidential election campaign this year, about the relative unimportance of campaign books nowadays, and we'll also be hearing from an Italian journalist about the assassination in Sicily this weekend of Italy's leading anti-mafia prosecutor.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. A lot of classic jazz has been reissued since the compact disc boom began in the mid-1980s. But jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says that too often, the way it's reissued doesn't do justice to the material. He says sometimes the music is all right, but the production is all wrong, like a new CD of classic solos by pianist Thelonious Monk.
As a composer, Thelonious Monk was one of the founders of modern jazz, the bebop music that stayed modern for 50 years. But he doesn't sound like a bebop piano player. Boppers were into a fleet, light sound. Monk's approach was heavy and deliberate, built on thick sonic slabs instead of flowing lines. The album Solo Monk was made in 1964 and 5. He'd been recording for 20 years, but he'd never made his origins quite so explicit before. Monk didn't sound like a bopper because his roots were in ragtime-derived stride piano players, like his hero James P. Johnson. Monk lets you hear that Monk's not weird because he's avant-garde, but because he's old hat. On his blues North of the Sunset, he sounds like he's going for the sound of a logging camp piano, one of those broken-down instruments itinerant musicians played on 80 or 90 years ago. Pianos where a dozen keys didn't work and the rest put up a good fight. That's hardcore Monk, that combination of clunky sonority and perfect rhythmic placement. Solo Monk is mostly standards, a couple of them so old the cavemen sang them to the dinosaurs, but Monk treats dusty pop tunes with the same offhand familiarity as his own pieces. Monk is fashionable now among jazz piano players in the U.S. and in Holland. The Americans play his tunes, but the Dutch study his keyboard and pedal technique. That's why Misha Mengelberg and Michael Brahm get closer to Monk's sound and feel than Marcus Roberts or Michael Weiss do. As technician, Monk was master of the minor second, the clank of two adjacent keys struck at the same time. He got a world of acoustic effects through split-second discrepancies in attacking or releasing those notes. Monk perfected the illusion of bending notes on the piano. If you strike two neighboring keys together, then quickly release the higher one while holding the other down, the high note seems to slide into the low one. Solo Monk is a great record, and I'm glad it's back. But the new CD is one of those disastrous reissues that prove folks at the major labels don't always pay attention when they reissue old stuff. Besides the dozen tunes from the original album, there's a previously unissued version of Monk's tune Introspection. That's fine, except the first 6 seconds of it is a false start left on by mistake, or because no one noticed that's what it was. The CD also has a surprise bonus track, a trio take of Honeysuckle Rose that's not listed, not great, kind of disrupts the solo program, and which just isn't supposed to be there. I mean, how do you put an extra track on a CD and not notice? Even with it, the program's only 46 minutes long. Columbia owns other stuff they could have added, like Monk solos on Darn That Dream and the hymn This Is My Story, This Is My Song. They turned up on a 2-LP set Columbia put out in 79, but I guess no one who works there now remembers this. That's pretty sloppy. You deserve better. So does Monk.
Kevin Whitehead is a freelance writer based in New York. Joan Tuohy, Sue Spolin, and Sue Weinstein produced today's show, along with our director, Roberta Shorrock. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant, and our researcher is Ellen Silva. Terry Gross returns tomorrow. I'm Marty Moskowain.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, hooliganism and European soccer. Journalist Bill Buford joined up with a group of British soccer fans to find out why rioting and violence have become a part of the game. He'll speak with Terry Gross on the next Fresh Air. I hope you can join us.
chance of rain in the evening, 60% chance of showers overnight with a low near 50. It's